This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 21st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, more leaked documents show how the U.S. government collects domestic communications without getting a warrant. As protests continue in Brazil, we'll hear from demonstrators in Rio de Janeiro and get the latest on forced evictions of poor residents in Brazilian cities. And across the U.S., honeybees are dying in large numbers. Scientists warn it could disrupt agriculture and the global ecosystem. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The EPA has put on hold the U.S. government's first ever study linking fracking to groundwater contamination. The agency announced that it will not finalize the Pavilion, Wyoming groundwater investigation. Instead, officials say it will put its support behind a state-led inquiry. In a statement, the EPA said it stands behind its work and data and said that data will be included in Wyoming's study, which is expected out in fall 2014. The EPA's Pavilion investigation began in 2009 after residents complained their well water smelled and tasted bad. The report found groundwater contamination but could not prove conclusively where the pollution originated. After the EPA's draft report was released, the Wyoming legislature provided funds to build a system of water cisterns for the town of Pavilion. That project is expected to be completed soon, but residents who live in more rural areas still don't have alternative drinking water sources in place. Officials at Hanford Nuclear Reservation have found elevated radiation levels under an underground storage tank containing highly radioactive waste. The Superfund site in southern Washington state is storing massive amounts of Cold War-era nuclear waste. The single-walled underground tanks were not built strong enough to hold the toxic material long-term, and radiation has slowly been leaking into the Columbia River. The new suspected leak has been detected in a double-walled storage tank where the nuclear waste had been transferred. As federal officials and privacy advocates in the U.S. debate the government's mass collection of personal data, another country is set to get rid of private information that was illegally obtained. In the Republic of Georgia Sunday, officials are planning to destroy a cache of recordings secretly made of public figures. The tapes, allegedly illegally recorded by the previous government for purposes of blackmail, were found stored in the Interior Ministry. FSRN's MJ Del Valle has more from Tbilisi.
A dirty archive of private lives. This is how current Interior Minister Irakli Garibashvili described the files. The ministry says the recordings were obtained through illegal surveillance by the previous government of Mikhail Saakashvili. Among the recordings are private sexual encounters of public figures. The existence of the files has been known since early this year. They were supposed to be destroyed after an investigation wrapped up, but in May, one of these sex videos leaked. The destruction will now be overseen by a commission of senior officials and civil society representatives. Despite this, some fear additional copies may have already leaked. Parliament is expected to consider legislation that will grant amnesty to people who turn in recordings obtained through illegal surveillance. The initial investigation into the recordings has yet to yield any prosecutions. Another part of the archive contains recordings of political figures, but these are still under investigation and will be destroyed at a later stage. MJ Del Valle, FSRN, Tbilisi, Georgia.
Flooding in the Canadian city of Calgary and the surrounding areas has forced more than 70,000 people from their homes. Many government offices and businesses have closed, public transportation has ceased in some areas, and several communities are under a state of mandatory evacuation. One person has been reported missing, but no deaths have been confirmed. In India, the death toll from floods that began several days ago has now topped 550, and thousands more are missing. Heavy monsoon rains caused high waters and mudslides in the north-central state of Uttarakhand. Rescue efforts continue today, and an estimated 50,000 people are reportedly stranded in mountainous terrain. Staying in India, residents of Bhopal flexed some pre-election muscle today. They held a rally to let candidates know compensation for victims of the 1984 industrial gas disaster is their top priority. FSRN's Shuria Niazi reports.
In an attempt to awake political parties before the next provincial and general elections, hundreds of gas victims staged a rally in Bhopal. They want candidates to take up their long-standing demands for compensation and punishment of guilty individuals and corporations. Bhopal gas survivors say they will support only those political parties that will help them fight the continuing injustice. Meanwhile, the Kochar Commission, the group investigating the handling of the Bhopal disaster and its aftermath, is pressing the Prime Minister's office to release information about the arrest and subsequent release of the man many hold responsible. Former Union Carbide Corporation CEO Warren Anderson was arrested in Bhopal after the massive gas leak. But officials eventually released him on bail and allegedly provided him a government plane to fly to Delhi. Anderson made it back to the United States. Despite requests from India, the American government has refused to extradite him for trial. Shuranyazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Barack Obama nominated James Comey today to be the new director of the FBI. Comey was the deputy attorney general for President George W. Bush, and in that role signed off on the administration's warrantless wiretapping program. If confirmed, he would lead another federal agency accused of illegal surveillance practices. The announcement comes amid new revelations about the U.S. government's spying powers, including documents leaked to The Guardian that show the government does at times collect domestic U.S. communications without a warrant. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Following revelations earlier this month about the surveillance practices of the U.S. government, particularly the PRISM program that taps into most online communications and the NSA's vast collection and storage of phone records, The Guardian published two more leaked legal documents on Thursday. They are memos sent from the Justice Department to the FISA court in 2009 with instructions on how they should go about approving requests to surveil U.S. citizens and foreign nationals. Document sets guidelines for when the government can and cannot spy on and retain data on U.S. citizens. But attorney Heidi Boghossian with the National Lawyers Guild says the rules are so vague she finds them disturbing.
A lot of latitude is given to analysts at the NSA to make the decision of whether the contents include so-called foreign intelligence information. Seems they're given a lot of discretion. The standard for keeping a recording or a transcript is just that they reasonably believe there might have evidence of a crime. And although they are supposed to delete or redact Americans' names from reports that they write, there are many exceptions to that. And it just seems ripe for potential abuse depending on the particular analyst who's in charge of the information.
The memo states that data from or about U.S. citizens that's picked up inadvertently by the NSA can be held for up to 5 years. It also says personal domestic data that's been encrypted with special software, which many people do in an effort to protect their privacy, can be handed over to the FBI or disseminated to other elements of the U.S. government, and can be held until the government figures out how to crack the code. Boghossian added that the FISA court receiving these memos is too secretive to be trusted. An 11-member panel entirely appointed by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, the FISA court conducts its hearings and announces its rulings behind closed doors. The only transparency is a yearly letter to Congress listing how many government requests for surveillance they approved and how many they turned down. According to the court's 2012 report, they approved all but one of nearly 1,800 applications for electronic surveillance, and that one was withdrawn by the government. Each of those secret applications could have authorized surveillance on many people at once.
The question has become, do you want to spy on terrorists or don't you? And that's not the choice you have here, right? The question is, are you going to spy on the rest of us in the meantime, in the hopes that you dig up something on a terrorist?
That's Counsel Michelle Richardson with the American Civil Liberties Union, speaking at a briefing Friday on Capitol Hill, organized by the Congressional Internet Caucus. Among other concerns about the government's recently revealed surveillance activities, Richardson took issue with President Obama's claim during an interview with PBS this week that the FISA court provides appropriate oversight.
It's important to remember that this is not an adversarial process. No one is representing the interests of the people whose records are collected. It is just the government before a secret court, and no one is representing the other side.
Several others at the briefing, including Julian Sanchez with the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute, critiqued not just the surveillance rules used by the FISA court, the NSA, and other federal agencies, but the overall structure of how the government gathers and uses personal data.
Once you've got data, you've got the data, and the back-end restrictions on what you do with it last only until you decide to change them, and the record so far suggests we won't necessarily know if they decide to change them.
Those gathered at the Capitol Hill briefing Friday say they want President Obama to nominate someone to be the Privacy and Civil Liberties Officer for the Justice Department, a position that has been vacant since August. They also expressed their support for bills recently introduced in Congress to curtail the government's spying powers by amending the Patriot Act and making the government prove probable cause and get a court warrant before surveilling a U.S. citizen. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff met with cabinet ministers today in an emergency meeting as widespread demonstrations continue in Brazil, with more than 100 protests taking place across the country Thursday, including in Sao Paulo, Porto Alegre, and the capital, Brasilia. One protester was killed and others injured in Sao Paulo state after a vehicle drove into a crowd. What began as a protest over increasing bus fares 1 week ago has grown into countrywide demonstrations targeted at the high costs of the current and upcoming sports events and demanding better public services. Police have responded with force using tear gas, pepper spray, and horses. FSRN Sam Cowie reports from Rio de Janeiro.
At 5 p.m. in the downtown district of Candelaria, a group of around 300,000 people march along Avenida Presidente Vargas towards Rio de Janeiro City Hall in the second mass protest to hit the city in this week. The mood is upbeat and jovial. In a show of solidarity, office workers and residents drop shredded white paper out of the windows of buildings overlooking Avenida Presidente Vargas. Many carry signs and banners demanding for an array of rights and social improvements. Marisa Silva is a 21-year-old chemical engineering student.
And why did you come here tonight, Marisa?
Because for the first time, I think in 20 years, we tried to practice our democracy. We don't have education, we don't have hospital.
Sparked from a hike in transport fees, Brazilians from cities across the country have taken to the streets in a show of anger against rising living costs and poor public services, massive public spending on the up-and-coming sports events, and government corruption. Following Monday night's demonstrations in Rio and Sao Paulo, officials cancelled the proposed 10% bus fare increase. Other Brazilian cities have followed suit. Thursday's demonstration in Rio reached the city hall, where police on horseback and a high steel fence guarded the building against anticipated violence. In contrast to Monday night's protest, violence erupted quickly. Around 7 p.m, a small skirmish developed between one of the officers on horseback and a demonstrator. Police responded by firing tear gas and using the horses to disperse the crowd. The crowd is pushed back. Pockets of people remain, breaking up the curbs into rocks to use as missiles against the police. The scene is chaotic. Police assemble behind steel shields and start firing rubber bullets at attacking demonstrators. The smoke becomes heavier. Fabio, an evangelical pastor from Rio's northern suburbs, offers his account of what happened.
This is messed up. Here you have women, children, and old people in the crowd. The police have responded to a peaceful protest with gas bombs and pepper gas.
Nearby, volunteer medics help a young man with a head injury. As the majority of peaceful demonstrators depart the scene, police continue to fire tear gas at the huge, slow-moving crowd. People shout, "Sem correr," or don't run to prevent a stampede. Some distribute vinegar to counteract the effect of the tear gas. Bruno, a 25-year-old who works as an inspector for an oil rig, has been tear gassed badly.
Why did you come here today?
Oh, we came because we are tired, you know, like of this corruption. And, you know, we if we don't do this, you know, what are we going to do? What? We need to achieve, man, better hops, you know, better transportation for the people. It's crazy, man.
Do you think that this is going to continue after tonight?
Yeah, they're talking about to do bigger tomorrow, you know, like, because we need to achieve something. You know, like, they just put down the 20 cents and we don't need these, you know, like, we need more stuff, you know. That's it, bro.
Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, called an emergency meeting for Friday with cabinet members and cancelled a trip to Japan later this month. These are the biggest demonstrations Brazil has seen in 20 years, and if the popular protest movement continues to grow, it's possible that further changes could be implemented to a society that feels that it has worked too hard for too long for not enough in return. Sam Cowie, Free Speech Radio News, Rio de Janeiro.
As the protests in Brazil continue, one of the primary issues that has emerged is the vast sums of money and resources the government is allocating for several high-profile sporting events. Demonstrators say that vital services like healthcare, education, and transportation remain underfunded, while Brazil is on pace to spend up to $40 billion on the upcoming World Cup soccer tournament. That project has led to the forced removal of thousands of mostly poor urban residents from Brazilian cities and a housing crisis that reveals the inequality gap that some residents are protesting. Raquel Rolnick is the UN's special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing. She joins us now from Sao Paulo. Raquel Rolnick, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
You've called for the Brazilian government to follow due process when moving people for these mega sporting events. How extensive are these forced evictions, and where have they taken place?
First of all, it's very important to say that we are talking about several cities which are being prepared, are preparing to the World Cup. And in the case of Rio, which is the World Cup and also the Olympics. So there are 12 different cities which will be the hosts for the World Cup. And it's really not clear of how many families we are talking about, how many households we are talking about. It's very difficult to say, but I can tell you that in every city there are forced evictions going on right now, in every city that are hosting, preparing to host the World Cup.
Well, you mentioned the importance of Rio de Janeiro and as a host, as one of the primary hosts of the games coming up in the 2014 World Cup. But this week, the Confederations Cup has been taking place across Brazil. That's a major international soccer tournament seen as a precursor to the World Cup. And some of the protests have directly criticized the tournament. In Rio, the games are taking place at the Maracanã Stadium, which the government spent some $500 million to renovate. Dozens of favelas were demolished. What's the housing situation there?
Yes, it's true, absolutely true. I saw a very illustrative placard saying that when my child will be sick, I will take him to the stadium. So what is being said on the street is that we don't want to spend that much money to do the World Cup and to prepare the country for the World Cup. We need investments in, we need social investments in education, in health, in public transportation, which is one of the main drivers of the protest, and also on adequate housing.
Now, in response to some of these criticisms, the government says that it does have a resettlement program. In Rio de Janeiro, for example, Pierre Batista, the city's secretary of housing, said some 20,000 people have been relocated since 2009. Many are going to government housing projects. First, you talked about the lack of transparency about how many people are actually affected. So you can comment on if that number is even accurate. accurate, but how would you assess the relocation projects?
Yes, and this is one of the main violations, exactly the relocation projects, because most of the relocation projects are located in a place called Santa Cruz, which is on the western zone, sometimes 30, 40, 50 kilometers away from the places where people used to live, in a zone where hundreds and thousands of local housing are being built without employment opportunities, without cultural opportunities. So that is the creation of a huge ghetto. And it's very exclusionary and very discriminatory in terms of relocation. So this is exactly one of the problems with the relocation policy that being in place and led by Rio de Janeiro City Administration.
Raquel Ronick, as the UN's Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, you've reported on other countries. You visited the U.S. recently. Also, most recently, you were in Indonesia. We're now seeing these hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in the streets in multiple cities in Brazil. What legal paths or solutions are available for residents who are pushing for housing rights?
Yes, I think that it's a very important movement that is taking place everywhere. I can see a very important link between what is going on in Brazil, the Right to the City movement in Brazil, what is going on in Istanbul right now, which is also a Right to the City movement. So I think it's time to rethink, and it's very important that this is being said not only in Europe, in the U.S. today, but also in emerging countries like Brazil today.
Raquel Ronick is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing. She joined us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Ms. Ronick, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
This week, as summer approaches, people around North America will be celebrating pollinators, the insects and other animals that feast on flowering plants and help make many fruits, vegetables, and nuts abundant. Both the U.S. Agriculture and Interior Departments have formally declared this week National Pollinator Week in the hopes of inspiring some support for some of nature's smallest agricultural workers. But the event comes as honeybees are dying in huge numbers. The U.S. government estimates that over the last decade, 10 million beehives have been lost. Scientists warn it could have a big impact on the planet's ecosystem. FSRN's Molly Stentz has more.
According to a recent survey from the United States Department of Agriculture, beekeepers across the country lost nearly a third of their honeybees so far this year. The losses were higher than in previous years, but not unexpected. Bee populations have been in decline since the 1950s, and with a more severe drop over the past decade, bees are now dying in greater numbers than ever before.
Over 30% is the new norm.
Dr. Jeff Pettis is a scientist at the USDA's Bee Research Lab outside of Washington, D.C., and one of the country's leading experts on bees.
Bees just aren't doing as well as they have been, and they're just not very robust, and so they end up dying for a variety of reasons.
Some beekeepers, like Mary Selly in the Madison, Wisconsin area, have lost a lot more than one-third of their hives. She estimates she lost 85% of her bees this winter.
It's costing me thousands of dollars just to stay in business.
Selly keeps more than 100 bee colonies on local farms across southern Wisconsin, each of which contains tens of thousands of bees that pollinate the fruits and vegetables on the farm. Selly and thousands of other beekeepers must buy new bees every year to replace the missing and dead colonies. Her bee colonies start out robust in the spring, but dwindle by fall and winter. Some losses are to be expected in a harsh climate, but she's noticed that her bees act differently now than in years past.
They're disoriented. They're stuck on plants, on a fence post. I just find them in places they shouldn't be. And I've observed this for a few years now.
And she's not the only one struggling to keep bees alive. Darold Kettlewell is the president of the Wisconsin Honey Producers Association. He raises bees in Milwaukee County and says it's harder now than it used to be.
But, you know, over the last couple decades, there's been just more and more problems for the beekeepers in trying to keep your hives alive over the winter. There's different strains of viruses. There's different strains of Nosema. There's different types of mites. There's the hive beetle. And all those factors all enter into the scenario where the hive gets weakened. And when the hive gets weakened, then it doesn't survive through the winter.
Some beekeepers find their bees missing or dead and blame themselves. But the trend is a global one, and the idea that individual beekeepers are to blame worldwide doesn't sit well with beekeepers like Sally.
I just can't believe we're all idiots, you know. I've been doing this for 35 years, and I'm a mindful beekeeper.
What's at stake with the widespread death of pollinators is not just the livelihood of America's beekeepers, but the American diet.
So without these animals, ecosystems would collapse, our food system would collapse. You know, we wouldn't eat our most nutritious food, the fruits, the vegetables, many of the nuts that we're, you know, that really make up a diverse diet.
That's Scott Hoffman Black, the executive director of the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, a nonprofit group fighting to save pollinators.
We cannot live on this planet without taking care of the bottom of the food chain. You know, we just will not have the quality of life that we do now.
There are many factors at work to harm bees, but a growing body of research has fingered one culprit in particular that may play a key role in suppressing the health of the bee colony. That's a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. As the name implies, they're derived from nicotine. They were developed to be less harmful to mammals than DDT and other forms of pesticides. Two British studies released earlier this year found these pesticides cause brain damage in bees, affecting their ability to forage and find their own hives. And a report on honeybee health published by the USDA also cited pesticides as a primary concern. Beekeepers and conservation groups, fed up with government inaction, sued the Environmental Protection Agency in March, hoping to halt the reapproval of these neonicotinoid pesticides. Center for Food Safety attorney Peter Jenkins, who represents the beekeepers, argues that EPA's pesticide approval process was flawed.
What's happened over the last year and a half is that there have literally been dozens of new studies that have come in to show that EPA's prior assessment was wrong, that they failed to look at a number of impacts, particularly at the chronic impacts on honeybees.
Jenkins hopes that the U.S. will follow Europe's lead, which has taken regulatory action in response to massive bee deaths there. Every European Union country will restrict the use of these particular pesticides beginning this December. The U.S. EPA says they need more research on the neonicotinoids before they're willing to act. But a recent die-off in Oregon is attracting attention and may inspire officials to take action. Earlier this month, an estimated 25,000 bumblebees were found dead near flowering trees in a shopping center parking lot. Conservationists that went to the scene said they had never seen a die-off on such a large scale. Oregon state officials are testing the bees to determine the cause of death. Their current suspicion is a neonicotinoid insecticide called Safari that had been sprayed on the trees. Molly Stentz, Free Speech, Radio News.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.